Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much, Aaron, and thank you all for coming to listen to me. Although I have to say it's quite a tall order I've got, predicting the unintended consequences of policy presents anyone with a difficult challenge. After all, if we could predict them all, they probably wouldn't be unintended. Or at any rate, there would no longer be an excuse for the consequences not having been foreseen. But fortunately, I've got recourse to a very prominent typology, which comes from Donald Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense. It's actually much ridiculed this, I think very, very unfairly, because I think actually the distinction he made between known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns is actually a rather good characterization of how we should think about the consequences of policy. Thereafter, there are knowns, the formal objectives of policy. There are the known unknowns, things that are probably fairly easy to predict, at least in broad outline, and also may actually include some covert policy objectives, which just it's not very politic to emphasize. And then there are the unknown unknowns, those consequences that are genuinely unintended and unpredictable, often because circumstances and contexts change significantly. So this morning I'd like to talk about the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. David Willis has talked to you about the knowns, so I'm going to concentrate on those two. The known unknowns, the kind of collateral consequences that in fact have been very widely talked about, but remain contestable in their detailed impact. And the unknown unknowns, the things that really genuinely do come out of left field. But first, let me just say a word about the origins of the Research Excellence Framework. Those of you with long memories will remember that originally there had been a review of the working of the former research assessment exercise chaired by the late Gareth Roberts, which had made a number of kind of evolutionary recommendations for improvement. But then it was an intervention from outside. It was actually an intervention from Gordon Brown, then the Chancellor of the Exchequer, not the Prime Minister. Interesting enough, it wasn't an intervention from the Secretary of State for Education, who decided that that wouldn't be enough and announced that the RA would be replaced by the Research Excellence Framework, which would attempt to assess not just quality, but particularly impact. And I can still remember the Treasury-inspired announcement because I was then a member of the Hefke board, and some of us grumbled. In fact, I remember Richard Sykes of Imperial College probably doing a bit more than grumbling, that surely it was actually up to Hefke and the other funding council to decide the future shape of research assessment, not the government. But that brings me to the kind of first known unknown. How different in reality, in practice, is the REF going to be? After all, we're all sort of familiar with the detailed metrics and the rules, how the rules are different and so on. But do we really expect substantially different outcomes? In two senses. First of all, will the winners and losers, if I can put it as crudely as that, will they be different? I don't think many people are expecting that. And in a second sense, I mean, to what extent do we really feel that behavior has been changed? I mean, I'm talking about behavior in a fundamental kind of deep behavior, not in terms of kind of strategic and tactical adjustments to how you actually construct an entry. And again, I think it's very unclear at this stage how much that has happened. After all, the REF, like the RAE before it, will be an assessment system rooted in peer review, still focused predominantly in the minds of most of the people who are going to be entered and who are constructing entries, but also, I think, in reality, focused predominantly on the ranking of the quality of individual research outputs. It is unlikely, I think, to be a system designed to reward those institutions and units of assessment and individuals that have actually made the greatest contribution to driving innovation in a kind of more strategic sense. A while ago, I was the co-author of a book called The New Production of Knowledge, in which we suggested, controversially, and we received quite a lot of criticism for saying that, that the traditional mode of scientific production, which we labelled mode one, was being kind of overlaid, not replaced, overlaid by a new mode of wider knowledge production, which we labelled mode two. I won't go into the details of what that were. But described in these terms, I think the REF is likely to be a much more a mode one operation than a mode two operation. But maybe I'll be proved to be wrong. And from that, I think, flows a second known unknown, the extent to which the alleged bias against interdisciplinary and more applied forms of research will be reduced in the REF. Now, here it's important to emphasize, as David Willetts did very strongly before the coffee break, that there was and is nothing at all remotely restrictive about the definition of research that embraces all kinds of modes. It's an extremely broad, comprehensive, holistic view of research. And, of course, in fact, the Funding Council specifically warned, as David Willetts did also this morning, against using where research is published, impact ratings, and all those kind of things of journals as a substitute for judging its quality. As David Willetts said, I mean, that's the panel's job to actually judge the quality, not to take a lot of proxies. But in reality, first, panel members faced with high workloads, and some will be faced with impossibly high workloads and volumes of research output that cannot be possibly be individually and rigorously assessed, have to fall back on some kinds of proxies. And they cannot ignore, I think, the degree to which outputs have already met quality thresholds through various forms of other peer review. It seems to me inevitable. And secondly, institutions and individuals cannot be prevented from making assumptions. Perhaps these assumptions are wrong, but making assumptions about what research counts. Hence, perhaps there may be excessive focus on publications in refereed journals, all neatly graded by their impact factors. A third known unknown is that all measuring tools, as we know, inevitably affect what they are trying to measure. The RAE and now the REF are really well-established features of the higher education landscape. After all, the first RAE was undertaken more than a quarter of a century ago, in 1987. This has been around a long time and has been shaping behavior and attitudes for a long time. So it's hardly surprising that research assessment has encouraged certain kinds of behavior while discouraging others, inevitably. Now, some of these behaviors, such as upping the game in terms both of the quality and productivity of UK research, have been very positive, and those are the ones that tend to be emphasized. But others, such as the pressure to prematurely publish, I think particularly in the humanities and arts, often on the kind of vote early and vote often pattern, if I can put it like that, milking a particular set of data for all the kind of research outputs that could be constructed from it, or else the temptation to play games by constructing essentially artificial entries, hiring semi-detached sort of adjunct research stars of some kind. These kind of forms of behavior have been much more negative. Now, in outline, I think all these behaviors are well recognized, and therefore they can count as knowns, but their detailed impact is much, much harder to assess, and therefore I think counts as an unknown. And then a final known unknown is the strategies that institutions will adopt to maximize their performance. Indeed, how you actually define institutional performance. Will they seek to maximize their funding or their reputation? The rules of the REF have slightly changed the balance of that, but not fundamentally. Obviously, top research universities have to do both. They need to maximize their funding, but also they need to maximize their reputation. At the other end of the spectrum, less research-intensive universities, particularly, I suppose, the post-92 universities, clearly have an incentive to choose the latter, to focus on reputation rather than funding. Their QR funding typically is fairly insignificant. It could be defined as noise within their overall funding. But nevertheless, they can build reputation by entering a small number of carefully crafted submissions, and also, of course, see the benefits, and this is something that has not been mentioned so far, see the benefits in terms of higher positions in league tables. League tables are always the kind of ghost of the feast here. They're very important. But of course, for the middle mass of universities, those that used to be called rather negatively the squeezed middle, which is a bit unfair, but I think this probably applies to the majority of universities, the choice is a much, much more difficult and a much more delicate one. And again, of course, the overall phenomenon of how institutions construct their strategies in relation to the RAF is known. We know that these dilemmas exist, these delicate balances that need to be struck between reputation, funding requirements, institutional size, financial resilience, which also comes into the picture, and so on. But how this plays out in detail is not at all clear, and therefore I think must count as an unknown. Let me now move on to the unknown unknowns. The first and most significant, and Trevor mentioned this earlier, is how the new funding regime for teaching, the replacement of T funding from Hefke by tuition fees largely paid by students, will actually interact with future decisions on research funding. After all, we used to see this as a block grant. It's no longer a block grant in any realistic sense. They're earmarked grants, but nevertheless, we just don't know how these two systems are going to interact. But I think we can all speculate there are going to be very substantial interactions and really very unpredictable ones. Let me just attempt a couple which are highly speculative. One at a kind of institutional level. Take the example of arts and humanities departments, which, however insulted they may feel about the withdrawal of all T funding, if they are able to maintain their recruitment, will nevertheless nearly always receive actually more funding than they did through the current system, the old system. Now, one possible effect of that is that because they would be less dependent on QR income to pay the bills, I'm thinking of a small language department in a research-intensive university, which has often had to use a lot of its substantial QR funding to pay the bills, if I can put it like that, that they can also afford maybe to focus more on reputation and slim down their entries. Not only would smaller and more focused entries enhance at least the perception of quality, if not the quality itself, but also perhaps by having more identifiable research stars coming through out of that process, that could even help in branding and recruitment terms in terms of maintaining student recruitment, however illogical or disconnected that might be. So that's one example of a possible implication. A second example is the impact on the behavior of the funding council on Hefke. As successive RAEs, I think, uncovered more and more kind of islands of excellence, funding allocations had to be made more selective in reality to counteract this rather centrifugal effect, which is the true story, I think, of the RAE, that kind of this tension between the centrifugal effect of identifying more high-quality research, but you nevertheless need to kind of focus funding back, because we had, after all, to produce, quote, the right results. But if Hefke's role in the future is to shift from general funding to funding only STEM and strategic and vulnerable subjects, and also, crucially, providing QR funding, the pressure comes off in a way. I mean, Hefke no longer has to worry about the kind of overall consequences of the funding it provides. It doesn't need to think in terms of balance and implications. It is free, in a sense, to be much more selective. Now, whether that will happen or not, I'm not sure, perhaps not the first time round. Now, those are just two examples of some of the interactions that might take place between the reforms in T funding and the continuation of QR funding. I think there's likely to be a whole range of unforeseeable and therefore unintended effects of the revolution in T funding. After all, isn't it unreasonable to imagine that you can go from what Lord Brown in his report called a paradigm shift in how institutions are funded for teaching and somehow expect the stability and predictability of research funding has developed over 25 years somehow not to be affected? I think that's naive. But clearly those effects, whatever they must be, must count as unknown unknowns. That is the first big unknown, and it has to be unknown, largely because no one actually has bothered to examine it. Other unknowns are, well, frankly, they are unknown. But I'd like to end by leaving you with some thoughts. First, is it sensible to go on using research assessment as a kind of indirect and covert means of producing a clear differentiation of institutional strategies, or, well, let's be honest, a stratification of institutions? Now, the political advantages of using research assessment as a kind of stalking horse for that are obvious. I mean, the formal identification of research universities and the downgrade of the rest would, of course, be highly controversial. But it has two major drawbacks. First, it requires, in effect, the suppression of excellent research or the discouragement of excellent research simply because it is being produced in the kind of wrong institutional setting. And secondly, of course, it might risk producing the wrong winners. My second thought is to ask how seriously are we really about harnessing research in universities to innovation strategies in a deliberate and planned way? After all, that was the intention, the formal intention behind the shift from the RAE to the RAF, and also of the many valuable, but I would say actually chronically underpowered, underfunded initiatives to boost enterprise and technology transfer and so on, and commercialization. I mean, maybe we should just abandon the attempt to construct coordinated national R&Ds and innovation systems. I mean, after all, that in a sense would be more in tune with the free market political zeitgeist. Well, of course, it would be very contrary to the policies and strategies being pursued by many of our competitors in the global knowledge economy. And my third and last thought is to ask whether there is really any scope for radical simplification of research assessment. Of course, we must have such systems. The RAE in the past, the REF now, rather like democracy, is a lousy system. But it's just better than all the others. And it's certainly better than the bad old informal days, in the days of the University Grants Committee, when it was powered by a kind of strategy of what was called coyly informed prejudice. I mean, we don't want to go back there, do we? But many of the perverse effects and unintended consequences, the known, the unknown unknowns, arise from the complexity of the current system and the games we play around it. I mean, the devil, very literally, is actually often in the detail. I mean, there I must stop. I'm sorry that I have been no more successful than Donald Rumsfeld in clearing and identifying the knowns, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns. But thank you anyway for listening. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.